Here comes the Independent Indie Week from the North Carolina Reading Service, read today by John Federson. The issue dated June the 11th, 2026. It's intended for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. Fade music, bring up me. And here I am. All right, as an intro, a reintroduction to Indie Week, it is a website as well as a print issue that comes out every week or two. But the website is very current, including articles that are published right up to today when I opened my iPad and saw yet another one that I had not yet printed out for myself. And I will read that one first because it comes from IndieWeek.com, where all you listeners can avail yourself of this free publication that doesn't require to ask for a subscription or anything. And they have plenty of stuff. And on our website, which is ncreadingservice.org, this program itself becomes a podcast. You'll hear it on Friday, the 12th, and after that it goes into this mammoth file, kind of like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, some giant warehouse full of crates of previous episodes, well, dating back to the Pleistocene era. And you can look for these readings by various people over the decades from the Independent. All right, North Carolina sues chemical company for polluting a Durham creek. Acetone and ethanol, 1,4-dioxane and mucilaginous goo. I knew I practiced mucilaginous for a reason. For decades, state regulatory documents show a chemical repackaging and distribution company in Durham has discharged high levels of toxic chemicals as well as other unknown substances into a neighborhood creek that flows behind an elementary school, through a public park in a predominantly black neighborhood, and into a major drinking water supply. Now, the North Carolina Attorney General is suing Brentag Mid-South on behalf of state regulators over the alleged illegal releases, according to a complaint filed Monday in Durham Superior Court. And that complaint alleges Brentag is violating North Carolina's water quality laws. The state is asking the court to require the company to submit a plan to eliminate the discharge and clean up previous contamination within 30 days. City Councilman Nate Baker from Durham said, "I'm thrilled that the Attorney General is intervening in this long-standing environmental injustice. The residents living around Burton Park and further downstream have suffered too long from the negligence of a large corporate neighbor, and it is time the harms rendered be repaired." A company spokesman told Inside Climate News that Brentag does not generally comment on ongoing litigation. Earlier this year, the spokesperson provided a statement. "Brentag Mid-South is committed to collaboration in this investigative process and continues to expend internal and external resources and expertise in coordination with local authorities." Now, Brentag Mid-South is a subsidiary of a global chemical company based in Germany. That company, Brentag, reported $1 billion in gross profits in the first quarter of the year, according to public financial documents. Brentag purchased the Durham property and its corporate owner, South Chem, in 2001. Over the last year, the State Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ, has repeatedly cited Brentag for multiple violations related to water quality and reporting, yet the company has failed to improve on both counts, according to the complaint. It has yet to file several required documents, including a plan to eliminate the discharge, said the state. Instead, the company has asked for extensions and then blown those deadlines. DEQ Secretary Reed Wilson said, "Residents of Durham and across the state deserve clean water. It's our job as the state environmental agency to ensure that companies are following the law, and today we take another step toward ensuring that for those living downstream of this facility. Based on testing data, state and city officials believe the groundwater is the source of the contamination, which then discharges into the creek through a pipe at the property line. Groundwater monitoring conducted in March by a Brintag contractor showed that levels of more than half a dozen chemicals exceed state standards, including known carcinogens, benzene, and trichloroethane, also called TCE. Brentag has long known about groundwater contamination at the site. That property at 2000 East Pettigrew Street is a former cotton mill, which operated from the late 1800s through the 1930s and had its own lagoon. A Brentag Post spokesperson told Inside Climate News last year the issues affecting the creek, quote, are complex and may be the result of multiple sources that are not yet known with certainty. Brentag has taken numerous steps in close coordination with the city of Durham to help address these issues, unquote. Some of the polluting groundwater leaving Brentag site could originate from previous industrial processes. However, the plant itself has a long history of poor housekeeping. State records show inspectors have repeatedly found leaking and rusted barrels of chemicals, including as recently as last November. Regardless of the source, the company is still responsible for keeping contaminants from leaving the property. Since the city issued a no-discharge order in 2023, Brentag has collected and shipped its water off-site and installed a remediation system to treat the groundwater. However, the company shut off that system 2 years ago without explanations, state records show. Durham's stormwater quality manager, Michelle Woolfolk, told city council last month there is stuff buried under there. She said city officials had required Brentag to test and identify a black material found in the creek, which the company had yet to do. Since 2023, the city of Durham has fined Brentag $157,000 for various violations, but has yet to collect the penalties in hopes the company would fix the problem. But Brentag hasn't done so, according to Woolfolk's presentation to the council last month. Haw Riverkeeper Emily Sutton, who routinely samples the creek, told council the contamination is getting worse. It's an ongoing public health and environmental crisis. It's time to collect the penalties and accrue new ones until the discharge stops. Now, this article itself online has some illustrations and maps of where the creek is, Burton Park, etc. I can't tell you about those. They're just in there, and you can find for yourself if you're interested. Going on, testing conducted by Brentag contractors in last April showed levels of acetone at about 19,000 parts per billion. 19,000 parts per billion, nearly 10 times the state surface water standard. Concentrations of ethanol range from 25,000 to 144,000 parts per billion. That's 5 to 30 times the maximum allowed in surface water. The chemical 1,4-dioxin, which the EPA concluded has the potential to cause cancer, consistently exceeded the health agency advisory's goals. Sutton said, "These are not historical recordings. It's what's in the water right now." In August 23, the city fenced off the creek after Brentag contractors detected high levels of acetone, toluene, and ethanol in water at its property edge, a half mile upstream. City officials also collected what Woolfolk described as a ropey, brown, mucilaginous goo from the creek. Since then, the creek, which runs through Durham's oldest and largest public housing community, has been off limits. However, there are gaps in the plastic fencing, and it's easy to get into the creek. City Councilwoman Javiera Caballero said, "I played in creeks all the time growing up. What are the kids in the neighborhood doing? It's hot. People will play in the creek." The contamination problem has persisted since at least the mid-1990s, state records show, when high levels of at least a dozen chemicals were detected in the groundwater and in stormwater runoff at the property. At times, the creek has reeked so badly, said a state environmental specialist in 2004, quote, "Durham police have been called in to look for dead bodies," unquote. Brentag owns two other facilities in North Carolina, one in Greensboro and the other in Charlotte. Greensboro has a groundwater remediation system installed by a previous owner to treat contamination caused by spills and leaks that occurred before Bentag purchased that property as part of a merger in 2000. DEQ has fined that Charlotte plant $83,000 since 2022 for improperly storing hazardous waste, failing to have an adequate evacuation plan, and incomplete record keeping. Well, let's transition now to healthcare in general. Five things we learned from healthcare leaders' presentation to the Wake County Commissioners. In a nearly four-hour-long work session Monday afternoon, the Wake County Board of Commissioners heard from Wake Med and Atrium Health leaders about the proposed $2 billion merger between Wake County's independent nonprofit hospital system and Charlotte-based Atrium. The presentation comes ahead of a vote commissioners are expected to take later this summer on changes to Wake Med's Articles of Incorporation and Property Agreement. Here are five things we learned from that presentation. One, Wake Med approached Atrium Health about a merger and undertook a lengthy due diligence process. According to Board of Directors Chairman Thad McDonald III, Wake Med, in early 22, issued a request for proposals, RFP, seeking partners in oncology. Atrium Health was the only respondent, and further conversations revealed the two nonprofit hospital systems shared a similar mission and values, said McDonald. Following a, quote, deep dive into Atrium's culture and commitment to the local community, by the end of 23, Wake Med directed attorneys to look at a partnership between the two entities, and in January of 2024 proposed the merger to Wake Med's board executive committee. McDonald said, "Our initial response was much the same as some of you here and members of the community. What, give up our autonomy? We've also been fiercely proud of our independence. However, looking at the future of health care and especially the challenges facing safety net hospitals like ours, we felt it would be irresponsible not to give it vigorous due diligence." Over the next 2.5 years, said McDonald, Wake Med took a deep look at the state of health care in North Carolina, the future of so-called safety net hospitals, which provide care to vulnerable people and those who can't pay, and its capital needs. The evaluation, said McDonald, revealed almost insurmountable obstacles. After engaging advisors, finalizing terms, and receiving unanimous approval from its board, Wake Med leaders presented the proposal, including a transfer agreement and updated Articles of Incorporation to the Wake County Board of Commissioners in a closed session last March. The item was placed on the commissioners' consent agenda for their May 4th meeting, but the vote was delayed following public outcry from stakeholders concerned about the speed and secrecy surrounding the deal, the potential for increased health care costs to residents, and Atrium's level of investment in Wake Med. That's the first thing we learned. Two, leadership says the merger would mean more support for mental health services, affordable housing, and lower income residents in Wake County. Gene Woods, CEO of Atrium Health's parent company, told commissioners that one of the hospital system's main goals is, quote, to make a large system feel like a small community, end quote. To that end, Atrium has invested $2.5 billion in the North Carolina communities it serves. Atrium partners with 240 schools in Mecklenburg County to provide virtual services to diagnose and treat students while they are at school. That program treated more than 8,000 students this school year. Atrium also partnered with the Charlotte Housing Authority and others to invest $20 million in affordable housing via a housing impact fund and $2.6 million in expanding access to food. Atrium launched the first street medicine program in Charlotte where teams go into encampments to provide medical care for people experiencing homelessness. And it invested $1.4 million to reduce violence-driven injuries via its hospital-based violence intervention program. Woods said, to keep a community healthy, it's not just what happens inside the hospital walls, it's what happens outside the hospital walls. Board member from WakeMed, Margaret Bratton, said along with its $2 billion investment in capital projects in Wake County over the next 10 years, WakeMed's partnership with Atrium will allow it to contribute much more than the $400 million it currently provides in unreimbursed patient care, community outreach, education and health improvement contributions, and other community benefits. The consolidation will allow for expanded mental health services and access, partnerships with community groups on transitional and affordable housing, support for economic development in Southeast Raleigh, and an expansion of WakeMed's financial assistance policy. WakeMed could also explore partnering with Wake County Public Schools on virtual care. Third, a Wake Forest Baptist leader said its merger with Atrium has been a success. In a deal worth $3.5 billion made at the end of 2020 when healthcare systems across the nation were collapsing under the weight of the COVID pandemic, Wake Forest Baptist Hospital in Winston-Salem joined with Atrium Health. Kevin High, past president of Atrium Health Wake Forest Baptist, said, it would have been very easy for Atrium to say then or over the next several months or years about the challenge from the pandemic. We know we promised X, but things have changed under COVID, and we can only do Y. They never said that and followed through with the original agreement. I'm here to tell you that we are exponentially better 5 years later after this deal was initiated, and Atrium has delivered in every way. It's been a true partnership, not a takeover. Unquote. The 2020 combination has seen the addition of 8,200 new jobs and a minimum starting wage increase to $18.85 per hour. It's greatly expanded access to care in the area, including adding a new care tower on the Winston-Salem campus, an outpatient surgery center, Eye Institute, and an affordable housing initiative, plus further investments in Greensboro and Guilford County. I said, the combination of Wake Forest Baptist secured with Atrium Health not only preserved our stature and legacy, but expanded its reach. It allowed us to not only to survive, but thrive in all aspects of our mission. Number four, WakeMed leaders spoke about UNC's $5 billion offer made on May 6th, the day after the proposed merger with Atrium was made public. WakeMed leaders said they feel strongly that a three-system competitive market consisting of Duke Health, UNC Health, and WakeMed Atrium will serve the region best. McDonald, the WakeMed board chair, said, we've had a wonderful graduate medical education partnership with UNC for over 60 years, and I hope this will continue for another 60. However, we believe in a combination with UNC would decrease competition in this market. If we partnered with them, they would have 80% of the market. And in their proposal, yes, they had a larger offer, but there was a lack of detail on the investment of this additional $2.5 billion, especially in Southeast Raleigh, where it's needed the most. Choice for patients and choice for employees would be restricted. Furthermore, WakeMed has a signed agreement with Atrium Health, meaning it could not at this point entertain UNC's health offer if it wanted to. WakeMed President CEO Donald Ginzig told the commissioners, we looked for a partner, and I mentioned the criteria was the charity care mission, the mission to care for all, a culture match. That's the difference between a sale and joining a family. And Ginzig said he believes the region will still see big investments from UNC. I suspect, quote, like WakeMed, they've got plans to expand and grow services, and they have asked for certificates of need to build new hospitals. They're going to invest here. Duke's going to invest here, and WakeMed and Atrium, hopefully, are going to continue to invest here. 5. WakeMed has ambitious goals with the merger. Ginzburg told commissioners, WakeMed hopes to add more than 3,000 local jobs over the next 5 years across clinical, research, and support roles. Other goals include updating and expanding the campus hospitals in Southeast and North Raleigh, Cary, and Garner, adding 2 new HealthPlex locations, solidifying the state's largest virtual care network, providing broader reach with charity care, advancing specialty care, and opening the state's largest mental health network with more than 360 beds, as well as expanding mental health access statewide. In response to a question from Commissioner Shanika Thomas about what he would like to tell people about this partnership in 5 years' time, Ginzburg said he would want to be able to say that WakeMed was brave enough to make the best decision for the community's future at a time when it didn't absolutely have to. And he said, I will get great joy from that. It's really about planting a tree that I'll never sit under the shade. Also from Wake County Commissioners, they are poised to support a well-fed garden as the new site for Athens Drive Community Library. This is a 2.6-acre site in southwest Raleigh for the replacement of the Athens Drive High School Community Library. At a special meeting Monday, commissioners heard from county staff about 2 options the county has zeroed in for the new library. The 2.5-acre well-fed community garden, located directly across the street from the high school, and a 12-acre site currently owned by the Wake County Public School System at the intersection of Tryon Road and Yates Mill Road, located nearly 3 miles away inside Cary town limits. The commissioners are scheduled to vote on this new site at their regular meeting next week, but indicated at the end of the special meeting on Monday which way they were leaning. 5 of the 7 commissioners said they supported well-fed garden. 2 commissioners, Susan Evans and Vicki Adamson, said they supported Tryon Road. The upcoming vote follows years of advocacy from library patrons and community members who have lobbied to keep the replacement library local. $142 million library bond that voters approved in 2024 will pay for construction of the new library along with several other library projects around the county. Wake County Assistant Manager Ashley Jacobs said county staff had come to a negotiated sales agreement with Arthur and Anya Gordon, the current owners of Well-Fed Community Gardens, for $1.5 million, down from an initial asking price of $1.8 million. The Cary site is already owned by the Wake County School System, which would save the county money, but is not as accessible to public transit for low-income residents. Currently, the closest GO Triangle bus stop to the Tryon Road site is 2/3 of a mile away, and a GO Cary stop 1/3 of a mile away. While there is no bus stop at the Tryon Road site, Commissioner Evans, Transit Liaison to the board, said GO Triangle would consider adding a bus stop at the Tryon Road site if the new library were to be placed there, though there are currently no plans for a stop at that site. Evans and Adamson's preference for Tryon Road site stemmed from its larger size and the potential for expansion in the growing area of the county. In her presentation to the commissioners, Jacobs said a 4 to 5 acre site is typical for a community branch, and a 7 to 8 acres is needed for future expansion. Evans, whose district covers both proposed sites, said, I'm focused on how we serve the entire region, that is, southwest Raleigh, Swift Creek, unincorporated area going down toward Lake Wheeler, all of that needs to be served by this library as effectively as possible, and we need to plan for the years to come. And while, yes, it's a replacement for Athens Drive Library, for me, it would have to be decided upon what is going to best serve the whole area. The pro for the Wilford Garden, it's in the existing community, it's walkability, it's close to the high school, but it is not the optimal size for what we would like to see, and it doesn't allow us any ability for expansion of the library. That causes me some concern. For other commissioners, the accessibility of Wilford site is its selling point. It also serves as a greater number of residents right now, 125,000, as opposed to just under 100,000 with Tryon, living within a 10-minute drive to the library. That's a key metric the county considers in its planning. And as Commissioner Sophia Jackson noted, there are already several regional libraries serving the area, including Southeast Regional and Oberlin Regional in Raleigh, Cary Regional and Eva Perry Regional in Cary. Jackson said there is something to be said about a community library sitting in the middle of the regional libraries and presenting all of those residents with the option of having a quaint community library experience, as well as the choice of a regional. We should be thinking about growth in this county, but I don't get the sense that the growth in this area is putting pressure on these other libraries, such that this one has to be regional to account for that much more growth. Several residents who supported keeping the Athens Drive Library local attended the meeting. They clapped and celebrated after the commissioners indicated they would likely select the Wilford Garden site. Yvonne Brannon, a longtime resident of Athens Drive neighborhood and one of the main organizers of Neighbors in support of keeping the library local, said, I'm shocked. This is really a story of the little guy taking on the big guy and winning. Well, this issue has got several articles concerned with various boards of commissioners taking various votes and stands on items, and here's one from Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools Board of Education. They will close Glenwood Elementary School permanently in the fall of 2027. That vote was unanimous last Thursday night. The decision comes amid declining school enrollment over the past 10 years. Student population in CHCCS declined from 12,000 students, that's 12,000, in 2016. 10 years later, 10,700. By 2036, the district estimates that the number will drop by 1,000 more, with 111 of those projected losses in elementary schools. These changes come as a result of falling birth rates, families moving out of the district, and parents sending their children to private and charter schools. The state provides funding per pupil, so with fewer students enrolled, the school system has a tighter budget. The board began discussing potential closures in the fall of 2025 to address the budget concerns, and in March, the board narrowed the list to 3 elementary schools, Ephesus, Glenwood, and Sewell. These schools were chosen based on their existing renovation needs, with each school more than 50 years old and requiring more than $20 million in repairs. On Thursday, the board voted to shutter Glenwood due to its position as a magnet school where students already commute from all parts of the district for its 2 Mandarin language programs. A report released in early May showed transportation costs to the district would remain similar after closing Glenwood, but it would cost the district more than $100,000 to change bus routes and send students further from their homes if either Ephesus or Sewell were to close. Glenwood students are in the STEAM, that is STEAM, Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, Math, and Mandarin, dual language program. They take half their classes in Mandarin, and the STEAM World Language Program incorporates 90 minutes of Mandarin per week. Now, Glenwood will open normally next school year for fall of 27. The school district plans to reallocate the 394 Glenwood students to other elementary schools where there are currently 1,100 empty seats, according to Deputy Superintendent of Operations Al Chirochi. By August 20, the school system will present options to the board for where that dual language and world language programs can be incorporated. Those two programs will likely have to separate, according to the district. Board member Melinda Manning said shutting a magnet program would be much less disruptive than a neighborhood school, saying students, in many cases, can follow their teachers and their programs and hope that community can work to stay intact. Glenwood parent Megan Goodwin said with the magnet program dissolving, she's considering private and charter school for her kids as soon as this fall, saying to the board, I think you'll find many families from Glenwood making the same hard decisions and plans, and this may not be the enrollment fix that you hoped. The decision to close Glenwood comes after a months-long discussion process with loyal families from each of the three institutions concerned that their child's school was on the chopping block. In February, the board waged closing two schools based on recommendations from the district, but those recommendations were adjusted in May to one school. In a packed meeting room Thursday evening, the room was clearly divided into three. Parents and teachers donned red "Ephes Us Is All of Us" shirts in the center section, facing that panel of board members. On the left was a mass of green with Glenwood Elementary sporting school colors and Gator shirts, and on the right a sea of blue in support of Sewell Elementary. Parent of a Sewell student said, I want to acknowledge the real damage of this process, pitting neighbor against neighbor and school against school. During an hour of public comment, parents and students from each of the three camps stood up to defend their schools. Then, one by one, several of the board members read prepared remarks ahead of the vote. Board member Barbara Fedders went first, announcing she would be voting to close Glenwood as the most logical choice. Parents in the room drew in their breath. Ronnie Dassey followed with similar remarks, then Meredith Ballou. At the fourth, council member Manning expressed preference toward closing that magnet. Glenwood families started filing out of the room. The board then cast its votes. Parents from each of the schools embraced each other, with Sewell and Ephesus families relieved to be in the clear. Glenwood parents gathered outside the meeting room, confused at the board's decision. Several Glenwood parents said that with the magnet school at the highest capacity of the three, currently at 96%, projected to reach 101% by 2036, it didn't make sense to close its door. Sewell is currently at 81% capacity and expected to drop to 76% by 2036. Ephesus is currently at 79% capacity, but based on plans for new housing developments nearby, that number is expected to grow to 97%. A Glenwood second grader named Javier walked up to the podium and pulled the microphone down so he could reach. He began speaking in Mandarin and concluded his speech in English. Quote, if Glenwood closes, many kids like me will have to leave the school. Teachers, friends, and routines that are important to us, that will make me feel very sad and worried, said Xavier. I know adults have to make hard decisions. I hope you remember this decision is not only about buildings for money. It's about kids, teachers, family, language, and a school community. His mother, Tongde Wu, told Indy she feels embedded in the Glenwood community, and the dual language program helped her son become confident in both Mandarin and English. Quote, I understand it's a hard decision, and they want to minimize the hardship on the process toward the community, but it's a real shock to me. They think that dissolving the program is the easiest way. Certainly, from where we sit, it's not. Wu expressed concern the Glenwood community will fracture if the programs are split, emphasizing the benefit of the dual language program in connecting her son with his Chinese heritage. Board member George Griffin told Indy, It's a legitimate concern of theirs, and I think we need to listen to that and pay attention if they're speaking their truth. So we need to put that at the top and say, okay, how can we help preserve a sense of community with whatever we do next? More schools, more commissioners, Durham County commissioners, up the DPS funding and taxes to pay for it in their final budget vote. They will increase funding from DPS by about $14.5 million. That's slightly more than what DPS administrators say would merely keep the district operating as is, not quite enough to fund the 12% classified staff raises that advocates lobbied for. The increase in county funding for DPS compared to last fiscal year falls $14 million short of the district's $28.5 million request. DPS proposal accounted for $11 million to maintain operations amid rising costs, plus $15 million for new initiatives, including raising classified staff pay, and $3 million for student laptop and classroom projector replacements. Durham County's total 26-27 allocation to DPS is $239 million. That's about one quarter of the entire county budget, which was adopted by the Durham County Board of Commissioners on Monday night, along with a 2.5-cent property tax increase for the upcoming fiscal year, largely to help account for DPS boost. Notably, the county's final DPS figure leaves little to no wiggle room for non-teaching staff, like bus drivers and custodians, to earn Durham County's minimum wage standard of $19.22 per hour. But for Durham County, even that $14.5 million increase was a stretch. County Manager Claudia Hager said at the Monday meeting, "We are balancing our residents' ability to pay property taxes, also with pressures that we're having to absorb because our federal and state partners have shifted how they support the organization." No kidding. DPS's initial county funding request would have pushed the district's minimum wage from $17.15 an hour to the county's $19.22. The pressure was on for the county. Amid ongoing state budget debates, legislators only expressed intent to fund 3% raises on average for state employees, including classified workers. At Monday's meeting, Durham County Commissioner Chair Mike Lee said DPS classified workers would see a minimum wage of $18.22 per hour with the county's funding increase. This comes after DPS Chief Finance Officer Jeremy Teeter acquiesced at the commissioner's May 21 budget work session that the district could, by lessening operational expenditures, find enough savings to give classified staff raises without that full $28.5 million increase from Durham County. The Durham Association of Educators, the DAE, had successfully pushed the district to request that $28.5 million from the county in March. Upon seeing that Hager's initial budget proposal only made room for an $11 million increase, the Educators Union pressured county commissioners to up the funding for DPS to account for classified raises. Hager originally proposed increasing property taxes by 2%, but DAA wanted the county to double down and raise them by 4 cents to fulfill DPS request in full. Many classified workers are also still sore from DPS promising raises in 2023, only to claw them back from 1,300 of nearly 2,200 employees a few months later after the district revealed a, quote, accounting error. Since then, staff members have been left without a raise that keeps pace with rising costs. The board heard testimonies about the draining workloads of two DPS physical therapists who warned low pay would continue to force talented staff to leave the school system. Physical therapist Heidi Hetland said during the public comment period, gesturing to herself and colleague, "Over the past years, the PT department of 9 people has lost 6. You, right now, are looking at half the department that covers the entire county. Right before Monday's budget vote, the board had a lengthy discussion about giving classified workers more than the manager proposed. Vice Chair Nita Alam made a final ask that the county, quote, close the gap to pay DPS workers a living wage this fiscal year in case the county doesn't have flexibility to do so next budget season. Commissioner Michelle Burton backed Alam's proposition, suggesting an additional 25-cent raise in property taxes on top of the 2.5-cent increase they were set to vote on. But the other three commissioners, Lee, Wendy Jacobs, and Stephen Ballantyne, as well as Hager, staunchly advocated against additional tax hikes, which leading to an ultimate board consensus on that 2.5-cent increase. Commissioners agreed that the county would try to achieve a 1922 minimum wage for classified workers next year. Jacob said, addressing the classified workers, there is no question that your needs and the heartbreaking stories that we've heard should be funded. The problem? We have other heartbreaking needs happening. Jacob cited the additional financial pressure on the county due to the Trump administration's cut to social services, including Medicaid and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. Multiple commissioners spoke to the financial toll of raising property taxes for residents and how even seemingly small hikes add up for those who are struggling to afford living in Durham. Well, the county's budget ordinance passed unanimously and takes effect on July the 1st, the start of the new fiscal year. DPS will be left to disperse the county's appropriation across its long list of priorities. More school choice in Wake County. Natalie Christley, a lifelong resident of North Carolina, originally intended to send her two children to traditional public school. Herbert Atkins Elementary, near her home in Holly Springs, had small classes and above-average test scores, exactly what she was looking for. Then, a few years before Christley's son was due to start kindergarten, Wake County Public School System reassigned her children away from their base schools. So Christley started looking at her options. She said as she toured public and charter schools around the area, "We were definitely looking at the quality of the education. I was also looking at schools that have a lot of diversity, at rankings on all the different websites, how they did their testing." This kind of school shopping is commonplace among parents nowadays, Apex Elementary School principal Kristen Small told the Indy. Charter schools, like traditional public schools, are free, creating an alternative for families who can't afford or don't want to send their children to private schools. Unlike traditional public schools, however, charters don't have to follow state learning standards or other state rules around school calendar or class size. They have a lot more flexibility and are typically founded on a charter that outlines a specific mission. To the dismay of public education advocates, they're also not required to meet the same standards when it comes to providing school transportation or lunches, which creates barriers for low-income students, advocates argue. Charters cannot legally reject students on the basis of race, income, English proficiency, disability, or special needs status, but persistently they have lower percentages of minority and low-income students compared to public schools, according to a 2025 report from nonprofit Public Schools First, NC. They also have lower percentages of students with special needs, disabilities, and those who speak English as a second language. As charters rise, tension is growing between proponents of a traditional public education, including local school board officials and groups like the NC Association of Educators, and the families of some 18,000 students in Wake who say charter schools meet their needs. Because with every new charter that opens, there's less money for traditional public schools. Wake County expert expects to lose around $81 million to charter this year as students increasingly move away from public schools. It's money that could have paid for full-time literacy coaches, school nurses, and more, said board member Lynn Edmonds. In an early draft of the budget, 130 special education teacher positions were on the chopping block. And while the school board was able to postpone those cuts, they still had to reject an ask for special ed support services, said Edmonds. Quote, our job is to provide students and educators with what they need to be successful. They are really hurting. We are not able to meet that need. That is agonizing. It keeps you up at night. State law allowing public school dollars to be diverted to charter and private schools are a big reason for the current budget crisis year over year. The state's chronic underfunding of public ed has forced the board to make budget cuts, according to Edmonds. The amount of money Wake County expects to lose to charters this year is about seven times as much as it was in 2011. That's because in 2011, the General Assembly removed its cap on the number of charters allowed statewide, allowing many more to open. Since then, the number of charters has more than doubled in Wake County, growing from 13 to 27. The growth of charters has been particularly rapid in western Wake County compared to other suburbs of Raleigh. Since 2011, six new charters have opened across Cary, Apex, and Holly Springs, compared to five in Raleigh, despite having about two-thirds of its population, and two in Wake Forest. In April, the Triangle Business Journal reported the Triangle Math and Science Academy, TMSA, a charter school network with schools across North Carolina, would open a new campus in Cary near the Star Line at South Hills Development off Buck Jones Road. TMSA already has three schools in Cary and Apex and is planning to build another in Durham in 2026. The new Cary campus will serve about 900 elementary and middle school students, according to a press release, and is likely to pull students from across the triangle. Likewise, the percentage of students enrolled in charters has gone up, while the percentage of students enrolled in traditional schools has gone down. When a student living in the district chooses a charter school, they take a certain amount of money in per-pupil funding with them from both the state and the county. At the state level, charter schools in Wake County received about $169 million for the 25-6 school year. According to a budget report, that's an average of $7,300 per pupil. Wake County, Christina Cole, Wake County President of the North Carolina Association of Educators, NCAE, quote, when enrollment in charters goes up, that does have a fiscal impact on public schools and classrooms. It's death by 1,000 paper cuts. A year-after-year increase has an impact on the entire system. Why charters? The flexibility of charters was one of the factors that appealed to Chrisley, who ended up enrolling her son in Apex Peak Charter Academy. Some charters focus on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, or embrace educational philosophies like Montessori, which involves hands-on learning. Others offer dual language immersion or a larger selection of advanced or college prep classes. Peak Charter, which opened in 2017 and serves elementary and middle school students, was ranked highly online and had the challenging academics Chrisley was looking for, she said. She felt like the charter's differentiated learning program would be more beneficial for her son than the public's academically or intellectually gifted program, she added. Quote, my son is neurodivergent and gifted, so it was important to me that he was going to a school that was going to challenge him educationally. This was his first year in differentiated learning, and it has been great for him. This is the first year he doesn't complain all the time that school is boring, because he's actually being challenged. Many public education advocates also worry about state and local funding being turned over to for-profit companies through a specific model that is growing across North Carolina and allows charter schools to be managed by for-profit education management organizations, or EMOs. Heather Coons, Director of Research and Communications for Public Schools First NC, says the charter school movement started out with teachers who just wanted more flexibility in smaller environments. But once the for-profit sector realized there could be money made in education, they started figuring out their model, and now they're really coming into North Carolina. As of early 2021, for-profit organizations ran 18% of the charter schools in North Carolina. According to a report, that includes at least 8 of the 27 in Wake County, 2 in Raleigh, and the rest scattered around the county. Peak Charter, for example, is operated by National Heritage Academies, a company that runs more than 90 charter schools across 9 states. According to the Network for Public Ed report, the company regularly uses sweeps contracts, which, quote, give for-profits the authority to run all services, all school services, in exchange for all or nearly all of the school's revenue, the report stated. In other words, a charter can use public education dollars to pay a for-profit company for educational services, like teachers, curriculum materials, administrative support, and testing. Whatever money is left over after the bills can accumulate as profit, the report stated. These kinds of charter schools are, especially problematic because their goal is not educating North Carolina's children. Their primary goal is to make money, said Christine Kushner, a former member of the Wake School Board. Christie, however, had nothing but good things to say about Peak. She's been impressed by the student performance. According to the school's 2025 report card, students there performed above the WCPS average when it came to math, science, and reading. In addition to enabling the rapid expansion of charter schools, the NCGA has made drastic cuts to accountability and oversight measures over the past 15 years. That's led to a large number of charters that can vary widely in quality. The Board of Education's 2023 Annual Charter Schools Report states, while some charters consistently demonstrate strong academic outcomes and exceed state standards, others face challenges related to student achievement, teacher retention, and resource allocation. At the end of the 24-25 school year, about one-third of the charter schools across the state were identified as, quote, continually low-performing by the State Board of Ed, according to the public schools report. That includes 13 charters that received state letter grades of D or F for 6 years in a row. By allowing so many private and charters to operate with public funding, the General Assembly is undermining traditional public school districts, said Kushner. She said it's creating this false narrative that public schools are somehow inferior, but they're not. Public schools have become much more innovative with college and career prep programs, which is a signature of some charters. In addition, charter schools can be just as exclusionary as private schools. That's often because they offer fewer support services compared to traditional public schools. Free and reduced lunch programs are rare, and some charters may require parents to do things like buy school uniforms or volunteer for a certain number of hours each month. One of the biggest obstacles is transportation. Charters typically don't have a bus system, placing an added burden on parents to arrange for school pickups and drop-offs. Chrisley, for example, drives her son 20 minutes to and from school each day. She also serves as vice president of the school's PTA. While she has a full-time job, her boss is very family first, she said. So I'm allowed to be more flexible with my hours and prioritize volunteering when I need to. That's not the case for everyone. Kushner said there are some parents who know their child will never be accepted by a private or charter school. They have a special education need, or the parent needs transportation, needs the meal offerings that public schools have. Public ed advocates say more accountability and transparency is needed when it comes to charter schools. that public schools first report advised the state to put a moratorium on new charter openings until reforms are made. The nonprofit's recommendations include banning the for-profit model and EMOs and returning oversight power to the State Board of Ed, where it once rested. Charters should also be required to follow the same rules as traditional public schools and create detailed plans about how to serve vulnerable students, the report stated. Kushner argues that more investment is needed in the public school system, not just financially, but also from families with school-aged children. Quote, in the end, you can't just think about your own child. You have to think of other people's children. What's best for your child is a peer group and a future society where all these kids have had a great chance to get a great education. Well, my time quickly draws to a close here. I'll just give you the highlights of an article about four North Carolina choreographers who are going to bring dynamic works to the American Dance Festival. This will occur on June the 22nd at Duke's Page Auditorium in Durham, outside the Duke campus, 7:30 p.m., and it's called Made in NC. First is Courtney Liu, the choreographer. I'm just going to give the little outline of the people choreographers represented. Courtney Liu is one. Another, Amanda K. Miller. It will present yet untitled piece. It'll contain many traces of her long and storied history as an international dance artist. Then Jabu Graybeal, tap dancer and choreographer, Jabu Graybeal. He has upwards of 125,000 followers, and tap and choreography. And then finally, the North Carolina State team spotlights their first male dancer. That's Graybeal, by the way. Then finally, Tracy Durbin, jazz dance teacher and choreographer. All these choreographers' works will be displayed on that date at Duke Page Auditorium. Again, June 27th, 7:30 p.m. And that brings us to the end of Indie Week. John Federson saying so long for this week. This program first aired on Friday, will be aired on Friday, and then will become a podcast, as all of these programs are at the North Carolina Reading Service. So go there on the internet, ncreadingservice.org. So for the aforementioned service, thank you very much for listening to Indie Week. Bye-bye.